Deutsche Welle, World in Progress.
In this program, how foundations can make a change in society.
That is what foundations can achieve, to actually put it on the agenda over and over again, and then see to it that also finally the politicians move in the right direction.
How food sharing could reduce tons of food waste.
This is also a mental change. I assume you buy differently, maybe less. Then you start also thinking about what am I buying. And the moment you start reflecting where does my food come from, you probably will buy differently.
And how some Islamic schools in India are now opening up to modern curricula and to non-Muslim students.
I thought that Muslims are bad people and they could not be friends of Hindus. But after joining this madrasa, I have found that this notion was completely incorrect.
Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Raspa in Bonn. While the international community met at the UN Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro last week, sustainability was also the motto at the annual meeting of the Association of German Foundations in Erfurt, Thuringia. With more than 1,500 participants, it's the biggest meeting of foundations of its kind. And that's not surprising. Germany has more than 19,000 foundations, more than any other European country. 9,000 of these have been set up in the past 10 years alone, mostly by private people using their wealth to support causes ranging from cultural and social projects to environmental issues and human rights. Dr. Wilhelm Krull is the chairman of the board of the Association of German Foundations, and he also heads one of Germany's biggest foundations, the Volkswagen Foundation. I first asked him why two or three new foundations are being set up every day in Germany now.
Well, this boom has been going on for the past 10 years. Each year we have had between 900 and 1,000 new foundations being set up, basically by people who accumulated their wealth after the Second World War. The current generation often is in the situation that also their children are by now quite well off, so they think about doing something useful, something extra with their money to pay back to a certain extent to society. This will probably continue despite the current financial and economic crisis because, as it is expected for Germany at least, another 4 trillion euros will be transferred from one generation to the other in this decade.
Taking place at the same time as this meeting here is the Rio Plus 20 conference in Rio, where world matters are being discussed, challenges facing humanity in the next century. It's climate change, poverty, and of course sustainability, the big topic. What role do you think should and can foundations play in facing these challenges?
Well, by their very nature, foundations have a strong interest in sustainability because they really want to keep their endowment in real terms, which is, of course, not easy these days with low interest rates and, let's say, even superseding inflation rates, etc. But let's say there are also more and more foundations engaging themselves, as far as their investments are concerned, in more sustainable mission-related investments, but also as far as their funding or their operating activities are concerned, they do engage in advocacy for these kind of questions related to climate change. They do fund research, technological development. They do fund a lot of things of climate adaptation in the third world. So there is a wide array of activities. But at the end of the day, we should not forget that the foundations cannot save the world. So what they can do is they can, let's say, provide what I would like to call islands of success. They can provide examples of how things can be changed, but they always need partners in order to make an impact on the politicians on the one hand, but also on the economy and other areas, particularly on these big global issues.
There are many financial problems now for foundations, and they have to find better ways of also networking to be effective still. How big do you think is the impact of the financial crisis on the foundations and their work?
Of course, many foundations in Germany as well as in all of Europe and in particular in the US have lost a lot of money during the economic crisis and are still confronted with a lot of challenges, but I will also look for other investment opportunities. But what is interesting in this respect is that people will look much more closely at what the respective companies are doing, and that ethical and ecological indicators play a much larger role before you finally take a decision. For instance, my foundation, we have exchanged one of these larger indices for one which is clearly an ecologically clear investment. So deliberately deciding to look for, let's say, high quality investments with a strong ethical component in it.
You mentioned before that foundations have to learn and continue to learn to be able also to survive and to adapt to changing societies. How big do you think is the capacity of foundations to be innovative?
Well, of course, my own foundation, the Volkswagen Foundation, may perhaps serve as an example where you can clearly see that this catalytic function of a foundation, in this case in the area of higher education and research, is used at least at two different levels. The one within Germany to provide incentives to move forward with certain steps and measures, like, for instance, granting postdoctoral researchers more independence, as we did in the so-called Lichtenberg professorships, where we provide 5 to 7 years or even up to 10 years of funding for somebody whom you trust that he or she will come up with really transformative ideas. As far as the international funding is concerned, it's got much more to do with lessons learned by myself as well as by the foundation after having spent some 20 years funding projects which would usually run for 2 to 3 years, help doctoral and postdoctoral students from third world countries to qualify for the next stage of their career. And that was usually just sufficient to actually make them move to the US or to France or other countries. So with this short-term funding, we even indirectly contributed to a brain drain from the respective parts of the third world. And the new approach was what I called at the time working our way towards symmetric partnerships, so that you get the African researchers in that case involved in the agenda setting for the call for proposals already. And also we committed ourselves that we would offer successive opportunities of funding. So after the first 3 years of, let's say, supporting a doctoral student, there would be an early stage postdoctoral fellowship and then a more senior postdoctoral fellowship and so on. So along the lines of the career, we would always provide additional incentives for the best minds to stay in Africa. And at the same time, they have the opportunity to publish in the top-notch journals and are really competitive. And I think that's important, particularly when you engage in such difficult things like the neglected tropical diseases in sub-Saharan Africa or the huge environmental challenges they are confronted with due to climate change, that you then see to it that it's not just a one-off kind of thing.
What makes you hopeful that the contribution of foundations and other civil society actors can really help make an effective change in the next 10 years to stop the many difficulties that we're facing?
It is always important that things are being put on the agenda. For instance, with respect to Rio, I could just refer to the Limits to Growth report, which the Volkswagen Foundation supported in the early 70s with 1 million Deutschmarks in order to get, let's say, this kind of dangerous situation we were already in at the time, and it has become unfortunately even more dangerous, on the agenda. And I think that many approaches, also the think tanks, but also research funding activities, can help to actually get this thing move forward. And I think that is what foundations can achieve, to actually put it on the agenda over and over again, and then see to it that also finally the politicians move in the right direction. But politicians alone also will not change, if not the entire society is willing also to change its attitude. So there will be many, many changes needed. And I think to discuss them and also to show that there are opportunities to implement new role models is needed for the future.
That was Dr. Wilhelm Krull, chairman of the board of the Association of German Foundations and secretary general of the Volkswagen Foundation. Bringing about change in society is also the focus of our next report. All over the world, millions of tons of food are thrown away every year, while 1 billion people suffer from hunger. In Germany alone, people throw away enough food to feed 15 million people every year. And that's just at the household level, say researchers. Filmmaker Valentin Thurn has helped to raise awareness about this problem over the past year through his documentary on food waste. And now he's heading a project to develop a smartphone app called Food Sharing. Kathleen Schuster reports.
You see the screen of the iPhone or any other smartphone, and on top of it is the logo Food Sharing, and then you have a map.
Valentin Thurn is explaining his latest idea to me. It's an app called Food Sharing. This is the idea. Don't throw away food that's still good. Give it away to a neighbor instead. Customers will always buy too much, says Thurn. But he and his project partners think that if people give away food from their fridge a few times, then they'll start to think about food differently.
If you go with your mouse or your finger on the dots, that shows you, okay, there is 10 kilo of potatoes.
The 49-year-old German filmmaker received international attention over the past year for his documentary Taste the Waste, which helped raise awareness about massive food waste in the West. Now, he has found a way to take his anti-food waste movement one step further by helping people to share food.
Every single item we don't throw away helps a little bit to reduce the demand on the world market. If the prices on the world grain markets are rising, poor people in Africa and Asia can buy less bread, for instance. This is the indirect consequence of our wasting to hunger.
Studies estimate that German households are responsible for more than half of all national food waste. Each person in Germany throws away an estimated 1.2 tons of food every year. That's enough to feed 15 million people. In response, the German government launched a series of anti-food waste initiatives in March. It's using a website and flyers to inform Germans about how to waste less food. But Thurn envisions a more interactive approach.
The moment you participate in such a scheme as food sharing, this is also a mental change. I assume you buy differently, and you buy maybe less, and then you start also thinking about what am I buying. And the moment you start reflecting where does my food come from, you probably will buy differently.
It's hard to say whether Thurn's idea of a food sharing app will work at all because he hasn't tested it yet. Plus, people could do this on their own without a smartphone, yet they don't. Some people at the Saturday market in Bonn explain why.
No, I wouldn't offer it to them. No, because if it had still been edible or good, then I would have eaten it myself. But I wouldn't do that for other people.
It would probably be a good idea. Friends live too far away. But if you were to ask your neighbors next door, they might think, well, I don't really need this, that I get edibles from you for free.
Though there's skepticism about the food sharing app, some people have already reduced their own food waste at home. A 2-hour drive north of Thurn's office, about a dozen members of the CSA farm in Trupp saunter from the courtyard into a compact side room. It's time to take their weekly pick from the farmer's produce. This week, it's mainly spinach, kohlrabi, and sheep's milk cheese. Most leave with only a small bag or box full because they only take what they need.
Here they really have to consider, what do I actually need? What am I going to take? It's also a matter of practice, because in the beginning, they take too much and then notice, oh, it's the end of the week and I haven't even used it. Then the next week, they take less and also need less.
That's Susanne Lindecke. She's lived and worked on the Entrup farm since 2007. The Entrup farm is one of Germany's 25 community-supported agriculture farms, or CSA farms. 120 members support this farm with a monthly fee and get a certain amount of produce in return. Membership has grown steadily since 2007. She believes her farming model shows that bringing people into closer contact with the source of their food changes how they treat food and gets them to waste less. Dumpster divers find that seeing where food ends up has a similar effect. Up the road in Münster, several college students get ready to go dumpster diving. Dumpster divers take home whatever they find from supermarket trash bins that's still edible, not because they can't afford to buy it, but because they want to make a point.
One night we rode back and forth four times and probably brought home about 30 kilos of good quality food and another 10 kilos of potatoes. So yeah, that makes a big impression on a person.
Moritz, who doesn't want his last name mentioned for legal reasons, began a year and a half ago after reading about how supermarkets throw away food they could still sell. Since dumpster diving is illegal in Germany, there aren't official statistics on how many people actually participate in this growing international protest movement. For Moritz and his friends, rummaging through dumpsters has changed how they see food.
When you read the next day that there are still a billion people starving, then it becomes clear that we lead luxurious lives. And so then I try really hard to treat food with more respect and to waste as little as possible. That's how change happens.
Dumpster divers want to send a message to supermarket chains and politicians. Moritz thinks Thun's idea of a food waste app is one of many necessary steps toward curbing food waste.
It's not a simple problem either, where you can make a blanket statement like, down with the evil companies. Just like you can't say, go dumpster diving. It's just a very complex problem. You have to find different ways to solve this problem, every person for himself, and then together too. Like I said, it's a long road, definitely not an easy one, but there's certainly not a single solution that will fix everything.
Thorn says there's a will in Germany to make a change. In fact, three cities have already expressed interest in testing out the food-sharing app in coming months. But while Thorn might be able to rid people of their wasteful habits like CSA farms and dumpster divers have done, he has another goal that might be even harder to accomplish.
There is an openness for awareness, but we want to change this into a move where people not only share food to save this physical food, but also to establish a culture of sharing.
Kathleen Schuster, DW, Cologne.
Still to come here on World in Progress, a report about modernized Muslim schools in West Bengal, India. But first, Zulfikar Abani takes a look at some development news.
Syria is too dangerous for monitors to resume work. United Nations peacekeeping chief Herr Vladsous reportedly said on Tuesday that the increasing danger in Syria made it impossible for the UN observer mission to consider resuming operations at the moment. With military operations from both sides still ongoing, civilians are in increasing danger. No independent journalism is possible from Syria at the moment, and the UN mission had suspended operations on June 16th due to the increasing risks to the 300-strong force of military observers who have been targeted with gunfire and bomb attacks. Across the country, the violence continued with at least 116 people killed on Tuesday, according to the Observatory for Human Rights. The UN assumes that in the past 16 months, more than 10,000 people have been killed in the conflict, many of them civilians. UN urges global fight against growing opium production. Global opium production rose last year as farmers in Afghanistan and Southeast Asian countries sought to profit from rising product prices, the UN Drug Agency reported earlier this week. Drug use is growing in developing countries, while consumption of opium products and cocaine has remained stable in industrialized regions, the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime warned. UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon said drug-related crimes threatened one of the world's most important goals, ensuring global sustainable development. The traffic in illicit drugs is thwarting progress of campaigns to fight poverty and underdevelopment. Conflict over Venezuelan stone used in arts project. Wolfgang von Schwarzenfels' sculptures in a Berlin park were meant to promote world peace, but the 79-year-old German now finds himself at war with a Venezuelan tribe which accuses him of stealing a sacred pink stone known to them as Grandmother. The dispute centres on a 30-ton rock that the indigenous Pimon people called Cueca, which they claimed was given without their consent to the German artist. Last week, the indigenous community in Venezuela staged a protest outside the German embassy in Caracas to demand the rock be repatriated. The rock had been in the Canaima National Park, home to the Pemon tribe in southeastern Venezuela until 1998, when it was given by ex-president Rafael Caldera to German artist Wolfgang von Schwarzenfeld as a gift. The German government said on Monday it was mediating talks for an amicable end to a row over the return of the rock. South Africa's most famous Bushman leader to get state funeral. South Africa will honour its most celebrated Khoisan leader, who battled internationally for his group's rights, with a state funeral in the Kalahari Desert, authorities said on Tuesday. National and provincial flags will fly at half-mast on Saturday for the burial of David Krupa, who died at the age of 71. He championed the cause of his indigenous tribe at the United Nations in Geneva in 1994. Krupa was the leader of 5,000 Khoisan, also called the Bushmen, the first known inhabitants of southern Africa. After forcing them off their land, South Africa's government returned 60,000 hectares to the Khoisan people in 1999, 5 years after the end of the white minority apartheid regime.
Zulfikar Abani with the development news. Madrasas are usually known as schools where Muslim children study only theology to become Islamic religious teachers or mullahs. After 9/11, many in the non-Islamic world began to think of South Asia's thousands of madrasas as potential breeding grounds for radical Islam and militancy. But in the Indian state of West Bengal, many of the more than 500 state-run madrasas teach modern curricula, and an increasing number of the students are now non-Muslims. These modernized madrasas of Bengal, where 500,000 pupils are now studying, are viewed as part of mainstream education in India, as Sheikh Azizur Rahman reports.
Bell rings at Chotushpalli Madrasa in Oldram village at the start of the day. Wearing blue and white uniforms, pupils from different classes gather in the middle of the madrasa's campus. More than 1,000 boys and girls stand in rows in an assembly facing their teachers. The 10 to 18-year-old children take an oath that they will study well, become good citizens, and serve their country patriotically. The morning assembly ends not with an Islamic prayer, but with the pupils and teachers together singing India's national anthem. The pre-class morning activities at Oldram are no different from other what we see at most mainstream public schools in India. This madrasa teaches physics, chemistry, biology, mathematics, geography, computer education, and other regular school subjects, including English.
The veil is overflowing with the sound.
Ki sound?
With the profound sound.
Profound sound. Yeah, profound means?
The state-run madrasa follows a mainstream school curriculum. That is the main reason why many non-Muslims are studying here along with Muslim students, says Headmaster Anwar Hussain.
Ordinary people believe that a madrasa is a place where pupils are taught religious subjects and that it has no connection with modern education. We've been working to change this notion for some years. After graduating from this madrasa, many pupils have ended up as doctors, engineers, and management professionals.
In fact, including Oldram, all 611 state-run madrasas in West Bengal have introduced a modern school curriculum in recent years, and male and female students study together. Unlike in traditional madrasas, no pupil has to read the Quran or practice any Islamic ritual. However, for all students, including the non-Muslims, Arabic and Islamic studies are compulsory. Headmaster Hussain says that the schools give non-Muslim pupils the chance to correct their stereotypes about Islam.
Before attending the madrasa, non-Muslim students usually have wrong ideas about this place and Islam. But once they enter the institution, they completely change their minds and return from the madrasa with a good impression about this place, Muslims and Islam.
Oldram Madrasa is one of only five madrasas in the state of West Bengal where non-Muslim pupils outnumber their Muslim counterparts. More than 61% of Oldram Madrasa's 1,178 students are Hindus, Christians or tribal animists. And 10 of the 30 teachers are Hindu. Teachers and students get on well, sometimes even playing volleyball together after classes. In recent years, communal conflicts have often been flaring up between Hindus and Muslims in India. Some Hindu students say their madrasa education has brought them closer to their Muslim counterparts, helping to at least partially bridge the historical divide between the two communities. Uttam Mistry is an 11th grade Hindu student at Orgram Madrasa.
As many say so, I thought that Muslims are bad people and they could not be friends of Hindus. But after joining this madrasa, I have found that this notion was completely incorrect. I think if Hindu students study here and mix with the Muslims, they will change their mind about the madrasas and Muslims.
In Hindu-dominated Indian society, until some years ago, madrasas carried a stigma and non-Muslims used to shun them. But people's mindset is changing. Dr. Humayun Kabir is a pediatrician who attended a modernized madrasa before studying medicine.
When I was in medical college, many of my classmates said that they could not believe that I had cleared the medical entrance test after studying in a madrasa. In the past, a stigma was attached to these madrasas, what kept non-Muslims away from these Islamic institutions. But now, following their massive modernizations, these madrasas are competing well with regular schools. The non-Muslims are no longer hesitant to send their children to these madrasas.
Like Dr. Kabir, the examples of Muslim students who attended the madrasas and are now successful in their careers have spurred many non-Muslim families to send their children to the madrasas. The fact that these schools, which are mostly located in rural areas, charge no fees, makes them increasingly attractive to students from poor and middle-class families of all faiths. But not everyone is happy with the modernization of the madrasas. Mr. Aziz Mubarki, National Secretary of South Asia Ulema Council in Kolkata, which represents Islamic scholars, argues that the government should not replace the traditional curriculum of madrasas.
No Muslim is against modern education at all. But then modern education at the cost of madrasa education is completely unacceptable. They could have introduced modern education in these madrasas without diluting their original religious curriculum. For all students, religious education is as important as is the modern scientific education. Both educations are necessary for better grooming of human beings.
Mr. Mubarki says that teaching boys and girls together at a madrasa is not appropriate and adds that the modernization is not serving Muslim interests.
Going by the requisites, a madrasa should have mosque inside its campus. The mosques have vanished inside these madrasas. Islamic religious education has been diluted simply to accommodate the non-Muslim students. So this modernization is not really targeted to help the backward Muslims.
In contrast, Professor Ghiyasuddin Siddiq, president of West Bengal Board of Madrasa Education that controls the madrasas, argues that Muslims are indeed benefiting from the modernization. He says that education is the most important key to help Indian Muslims.
After passing out of traditional madrasas, one can hardly think of doing any job outside the mosque. But now, in our madrasas, we are grooming students who can pursue advanced studies in almost any modern career. In the Hindu-majority society, our madrasas are not viewed as Muslims-only institutions anymore. It is immensely satisfying to see that the madrasas are now considered as good as regular schools and are serving the whole society.
In 2009, the Brookings Doha Center, a Qatar-based think tank, identified the modern madrasas of Bengal as models of secularism and up-to-date education and suggested that Pakistan emulate them. While the process of modernization continues, more non-Muslim pupils are expected to seek admission to Bengal's madrasas in the future. Sheikh Azizur Rahman, DW, Orgram, West Bengal, India.
And this report from India wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Thanks for joining me today. For more news on the topic of globalization, visit our webpage at dw.de/globalization. You can also listen to these reports and others online or download our World in Progress podcast. In next week's edition, we'll be talking about coping with trauma and spreading nonviolence in situations of conflict. Until then, on behalf of today's studio team here in Bonn, Eliane Giaducci and Helmut Schwieder, I'm Anke Rasper saying thanks for listening and goodbye.